Okay, today we're going to be dealing with the whole climax of the story of the Cold War. 1963, very important date in the history of the Cold War. It's the turning point between the Cold Wars, this very sharp international conflict, and the Cold War is the basis of a political system, system that provides the framework for an essentially stable international order, at least at the level of great power relations. You'll remember how the analysis of the Cold War is being framed. We identify the central problem in Europe, the problem of German power. We try and focus on those various points at which it seemed that a solution to that problem was within reach. The various points at which it seemed that a set of arrangements was coming into being that both sides could live with, really that all sides could live with. So we looked first at 1945, Potsdam understanding, amicable divorce, de facto tacit acceptance of spheres of influence. They run things on their side of the line, we run things on our side of the line. And then we analyzed why that didn't work. And then again, this whole period of tension, the early Cold War, it runs its course. Berlin blockade is a climactic event there. But all of those problems seem to be resolved by the spring of 1949. Right? Two states in Germany, the NATO system comes into being, the Soviets end the Berlin blockade. Once again, formal division of Europe into two spheres of influence, two German states, a formal institutionalized security structure and so on. Well, you'd think that this is the end of the road, that a settlement had been reached, but it wasn't to be. The world moves into a very sharp period of crisis the following year. Why not? We analyzed that question. And then again, 1954, the system of the Paris Accords, constraints on German power, Germany integrated in NATO, German power contained within a structure dominated by the United States. Western Europe protected by the NATO system, but the Soviet Union reassured because their number one concern in Europe, the control of German power, is provided for in that system. Both sides can live with it, it seems. But it doesn't work. We have this new period of crisis that begins with the Khrushchev-Berlin ultimatum in November of 58. What went wrong? Again, that question serves to focus the analysis. The Eisenhower nuclear sharing policy, Eisenhower's dream of a freestanding Europe, of America being able to pull out of Europe. Europe is the third great power mass in world affairs. And the consequences of that, nuclear sharing in particular, German control of nuclear weapons, of American nuclear weapons. Okay? And then finally we have the Kennedy period. Once again, you have this transformation of American policy. Kennedy policy very different from Eisenhower. Eisenhower wanted a freestanding Europe. Kennedy thinks that's just not viable. Eisenhower wanted America to pull out. Kennedy thinks there's no solution to the European security problem without an American presence. We're stuck in Europe, but if we're stuck in Europe, we should have the power to essentially dominate the western side of any crisis that may develop. We should have our hand on the rudder, since our own necks are on the chopping block. Right? Kennedy has this notion about how the two sides could live with each other. Neither side wants a war. What's the obvious arrangement? Well, it's the status quo. We respect Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence. We respect your special interest in Eastern Europe, is what Kennedy tells Khrushchev when they meet at Vienna in June of 1961. We understand your concerns about German power, meaning we'll keep Germany non-nuclear as part of this arrangement. But you have to respect us too. We understand your needs as a great power. We're willing to accommodate your power, but you should recognize that we're also a great power, and we also have certain interests, and we want something in exchange, and what we're asking for is that you lay off Berlin, you respect our interests in West Berlin. And so you would think that, well, great, this is the end of the story. The Soviets would have said, this is everything that we could conceivably hope for from the West. Let's wrap up the deal before these guys change their mind. But it doesn't happen that way. Khrushchev, you realize, is not a great statesman, not a sophisticated practitioner of realpolitik or anything like that. He sees the Americans making these concessions. He assumes that, well, this is because the Americans are scared of war. The Americans are scared of war, and they're making concessions. Well, keep that fear alive. You know, just give the tree another shake from time to time and see what sort of fruit falls out. So they don't wrap it up. The irony here, you see, is that Kennedy really wants peace, really wants a settlement, really wants to stabilize things and reach a political understanding with the other side. And that entails a shift from what American policy, Western policy had been prior to that point. We're willing to make concessions, but those concessions are taken as a sign of weakness by the other side. And the other side hardens its position. So a policy rooted in this desire to create peace actually has the opposite effect of increasing the level of tension because of its effect on the other side. You know, the big problem. And so you have this crisis, Berlin crisis, doesn't get resolved in 1961. It continues into 1962. The Kennedy administration makes a big attempt to resolve it. It understands the Europeans are very unhappy with this. Right? But the assumption is that's not important. If we can reach a deal with the Russians, the Europeans can be brought around. But there is this crisis in the alliance that's building up, starting in late 1961 and going through 62. We'll see today it reaches its climax in January of 1963. Okay. The key thing, though, is to reach a deal with the Soviets. And a big effort is made. Americans kind of present their plan in a more or less formal way in a document called the Principles Doctrine. March of 1962, it's this basic strategy. Both sides accept the status quo. Okay, but that entails, in particular, the status quo in Berlin. The Soviets should respect the right of the Western powers to garrison West Berlin and therefore to provide for the security of West Berlin. West Berlin should be under the military protection of the three Western powers and of them alone. Right? On the other hand, West Germany will be kept non-nuclear, and also the United States and the Western powers will take measures that demonstrate their acceptance of the political status quo in Europe, the status of the East German regime, in effect, move toward de facto recognition of the East German regime. Okay? The deal is on the table in a more or less formal way. Soviets are perfectly willing to pocket the concessions, but they're not willing to give anything in return. specifically with regard to Berlin. So the American attitude shifts in the summer of 1962. It's like, we're giving these people everything that they have a legitimate right to ask for, maybe even a little bit more. But even then, they're unwilling to recognize our basic interests. Even then, they're unwilling to kind of close the deal. It's like, if that's the case, if these people are behaving that way, even when they're relatively weak, because the United States still enjoys its nuclear superiority at this point, you can't just imagine what it would be like living with them when they're relatively strong. Just imagine what it would be like dealing with them when we lose our nuclear edge. And everyone understands that these are the waning months of American nuclear superiority. You know, people from the outset, people understood it was not going to last forever. And in fact, we know from a declassified document that President Kennedy was briefed by the Net Evaluation Subcommittee, which is the this organization within the government that was charged with analyzing the strategic balance. He was briefed for the first time in September of 1963 that the days of American nuclear superiority are over, that no matter how hard we strike, how fast we strike, it's not going to make any big difference in the end, because we're not going to be able to essentially wipe out everything that they have. You know, feeling up to that point is if we struck preemptively, the Soviets would not retaliate in such a way that would do, you know, really heavy damage to the United States, or even to Western Europe. Now that's no longer the case. Now they'll have enough left over that survives the attack to go on and retaliate and destroy the United States as a functioning society. And don't forget, it doesn't take too many of these thermonuclear explosives to be put on target in order to destroy an entire country, you know, like 40, 50 of these things. So they know this is coming. And they look at Soviet political behavior, and Kennedy's attitude is, and we know this actually from British sources, what he tells British Foreign Secretary. If a confrontation is inevitable, better sooner than later. See, it's a window argument, right? America has a window of opportunity to settle this thing. We had gone the extra mile in terms of trying to reach a political understanding, or you're dealing with people who just view your moderation as a sign of weakness. Conflict, confrontation, a showdown is inevitable. And in fact, the Soviets are saying this. They tell the Americans at this time that they're determined to put an end to the status quo in Berlin, to liquidate the rights of the Western powers in Berlin. They're going to be nice, however, and wait until after the midterm elections in November of 1962. But as soon as Kennedy gets through the midterm elections, then the Soviets are going to start heating this thing up again. So they know it's coming. They don't want to put it off to the point where America loses its nuclear edge. Well, that's the mentality that Kennedy and its top associates are in. When it's discovered that the Soviets had deployed these missiles to Cuba. As you know, a communist regime had installed itself in Cuba. Castro had come to power there in January of 1959. It's amazing to think that he's still around, you know, what, 53 years later. The Soviets had prevailed upon Castro to accept the deployment of these nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba. You know, you could, these short-range missiles, medium-range missiles, and so on, they're a lot cheaper to produce than intercontinental missiles. You can deploy a whole lot of them on Cuba. If they're launched, the Americans would have very little in the way of warning time. You know, it would have a significant effect on the strategic balance if enough of them were deployed there. Okay. And so Kennedy determines to seize on this to bring the matter to a head. This is the confrontation that the Soviets had been threatening. Well, if they want to have it out, this is as good occasion as any. The United States enjoys certain tactical advantages here. And the Americans insist that the missiles be withdrawn. We slap on a blockade around Cuba. We put our forces on alert. We make it clear that we're on the verge of invading that island. The Strategic Air Command is put on a very high state of alert, with the bombers flying, fully armed, along their attack routes, both over the pole and through the eastern Mediterranean, up to what's called their fail-safe point, where if they don't receive a positive order to continue, then they're supposed to turn back. But still, this is very scary from the Soviet point of view. Soviets don't do anything in response. They don't take preparatory measures to lessen their vulnerability, because anything they did along those lines would be viewed by the Americans as perhaps them getting ready to attack us. And it might trigger an American preemptive attack. So it's like one Air Force, U.S. Air Force general was privy to the information, said, you know, we had a gun to their heads and they didn't pull a muscle. Okay? The Soviets essentially give away. It wasn't a capitulation, pure and simple, because the Americans made certain concessions, but disguised concessions, the most important of which had to do with the American promise to withdraw the American missiles that had been deployed on the periphery of Soviet territory in Turkey and in Italy. These were Jupiter missiles. The Americans said, well, we had been planning on withdrawing them anyway. The president had ordered had already ordered their withdrawal and their replacement by missiles on Polaris submarines that were a lot less vulnerable. And it was just because the bureaucracy didn't carry out the president's orders that they hadn't been withdrawn yet. It turns out this was untrue, that that this was a real concession, that no such orders had been issued. Is one of the many ways in which the public was misled at this time. But the Soviets were told, we're going to pull out the Jupiter missiles. We'll give you that. But don't breathe a word of it in public. And if you do, everything's off. So the crisis, the missile crisis, is resolved, in effect, with the Soviets giving way. As I say, not a capitulation, pure and simple, but basically, the Americans had laid out an ultimatum, and the Soviets had complied with it. No countermeasures around Berlin. The blockade of Cuba wasn't met by a counterblockade against Berlin. Soviets were too weak to do that. The policy, the Khrushchev policy, had been a bluff. It had been engaging in bluster, not in serious policy. And now, the bankruptcy of his policy was revealed. By the way, this is one of the key elements that led to his ouster from power by his colleagues in the Soviet leadership the next year. They referred to as harebrained schemes. And in fact, you know, that's an accurate characterization. Okay. Cuban Missile Crisis, very important in terms of its consequences. When I was first talking about the missile crisis, I said, you know, people think of these crises as these kind of isolated events that just kind of pop up out of nowhere. They're very dramatic for a little period of time, and then they fade away. You know, and they think of international politics in terms of what makes it into the front page of the New York Times. You know, this very dramatic event, then that dramatic event, and so on. And the real insight that you get from studying these things is that's not the way this stuff should be understood at all. It's all kind of part of a story. The Cuban Missile Crisis makes sense only in the context of the Berlin Crisis. And the Berlin Crisis, of which it was the climactic episode, the Berlin Crisis has to be understood in terms of all these problems about America's place in Europe, should the Europeans be allowed to defend themselves, German nuclear weapons, and so on. All those things, deep structural problems. You see all this stuff, you know, getting played out. There's a story with a logic to it. All this stuff hangs together. Right? They don't just, these events don't just happen out of nowhere. And in terms of not just of their causes, but also in terms of their consequences. Okay? Consequences of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, the main consequence was that it revealed the bankruptcy of the Khrushchev policy. You know, the Khrushchev policy was based on this whole notion that Americans would never take a real risk of war. Well, here they were taking one. The Soviets were humiliated by having to kind of capitulate. Soviets, you know, there was this fear of the Soviets, they were these tough-minded communists, 10 feet tall. Well, it turned out they were ordinary human beings like anyone else. There's this notion in Europe, especially by de Gaulle, that the Americans would never take a real risk of war in the nuclear age. They would never risk the destruction of their own country for the sake of interests outside the United States. You know, he assumed the NATO system would collapse. We are at the hour of Munich, he said, 1961. Right? Well, it turned out that the Americans weren't going to give away. That Kennedy wasn't going, you know, he had made every effort at pursuing a moderate policy, but to no avail. It had been counterproductive. And he was not going to withdraw from Berlin with his tail between his legs and see the collapse of the whole American position in Europe and world as a whole. Americans were standing up. The NATO system was viable. Important changes. I mentioned to you about the Blaney argument about the role of war and just kind of making it clear what the real structure of power was. And I said, well, crises serve the same purpose, as indeed they do. This Cuban Missile Crisis served that important political purpose of revealing key information about the depth of American resolve and what the true structure of power actually was. Okay, so you have, and the missile crisis also changes Kennedy's own thinking. Well, his thinking hadn't been changing anyway. When he came to power in 1961, he had bought into this whole line of argument developed by, you know, a lot of his subordinates within the government that you had to really have a totally new NATO policy from what Eisenhower had. You had to kind of try and get all the Europeans out of the nuclear business. You had to prevent them from even having de facto access to American nuclear weapons there. All power should be concentrated in the hands of the United States. Europe should essentially be an American nuclear protectorate, right? And that policy had led to nothing but trouble for Kennedy. It had not solved the problem. The whole business of the MLF, the multilateral force, which these people had put forward as this great panacea to all these issues having to do with European access to nuclear weapons. For Kennedy's point of view, this thing was just a joke. It was ludicrous because it gave the Europeans nothing as long as the weapons there were under American control, American veto. So that policy had led to this sharp crisis in the NATO alliance without bringing about an understanding with the USSR that could serve as the basis of a stable international system. Okay? So he had been coming to the conclusion that I'm going to have to distance myself from prior American policy. It's not working. And then during the missile crisis, Kennedy wanted to, try for a negotiation. You know, he had a clear idea about what a negotiation would consist of. Turkish missiles, these American Jupiter missiles that were deployed especially in Turkey, these would be important bargaining counters that Kennedy thought could be given away in the course of a negotiation. And everyone in his government said, yeah?
You
the policy vis-a-vis the Europeans. That was not moderate. You were basically telling these people, you can't have nuclear weapons. The goal was to kind of infantilize them and make them into pure dependencies of the United States. And that didn't work because they hated the idea. Their policy vis-a-vis the Soviets, that was moderate policy. We're going to give you all this stuff at the expense of the Europeans, basically. And that didn't, to my mind, that didn't work because the Soviets interpreted that as proof of American weakness. These people are so scared of war that all we have to do is keep this fear of war going, and they'll keep making concessions after concession. You know, and that was a policy that had its limits, and those limits were revealed in October of 1962 at the time of the missile crisis. So you have, Kennedy, during the missile crisis, he's told by all of his advisors, you can't do this thing. You can't give away these American missiles in Turkey. All the NATO allies will get real upset about this. And then he would say, yeah, well, that's because they don't realize that if we don't reach a settlement, it could lead to war. And we should make them realize that. And then the answer there was, well, if they realized that, they would try to prevent you from taking a tough line in Cuba. And in any case, if you're going to scare them by the threat of war, then they're going to accuse you of being an appeaser and so on. And so going a public route, pursuing this policy in a direct way, simply was not viable. So Kennedy goes behind the backs of all of his advisors, pretty much, except for the Secretary of Defense, McNamara, and his brother, Robert. And he works out this private deal with the Russians. Look, those missiles from Turkey will be pulled out, but we have to do it in secret. And the crisis gets settled in what, for Kennedy, was a very satisfactory way. So he had ignored all these people again and worked things out in a way that he found satisfactory. So he had a much better sense of himself in his third year of office than he had at the beginning. And he had taken his measure of all these officials in the government, and frankly, he knew that he was a lot smarter than they were and that he had much better political sense. Kennedy was a very intelligent individual. And so he was prepared to change U.S. policy. Not vis-a-vis what was being offered to the Soviets. That remained intact. The basic line of policy is presented in the Principles document of March of 62. That's intact. This is how we'll stabilize things. But vis-a-vis the Europeans. Here, there was a very important shift in U.S. policy right after the missile crisis. And the occasion for this was what was called the Nassau Skybolt Affair. Okay. Yeah? Because then we wouldn't be bound by our part of the bargain. And our part of the bargain was we're not going to invade Cuba, we're not going to deploy any missiles in Turkey and so on. And they, countries make promises. They're much more honest with each other in private than they are with their own people in public. They're always misleading their own populations, right? It's a big mistake that political scientists make when they have this notion that the policy-making process I'm not going to bother. They said the policy-making process in a democracy is transparent. In reality, there's a huge gap between the real thinking that's going on inside the government and what the public is led to believe. But between the United States and the Soviet Union, when the Soviets promise something, then it's normal, if it's done in secret, for them to kind of keep that promise. And because that's the only way they can get the Americans to keep the promise. And it's the only way they could guarantee that what they say in these serious private discussions is going to be taken seriously. you know, that the credibility is an important factor. Okay, that's okay. So what does Kennedy do? Change his policy, not vis-a-vis the Soviets. That policy is still there, but vis-a-vis the Europeans. And how does he change it? Not on the core issue of should Germany have access to nuclear weapons. There, the U.S. is absolutely firm. No way. But on the other issues of the other Europeans, the British and the French. You recall that America had been very hostile to an independent French nuclear force and had come up with all these arguments against it. And this is one of the factors that it led to the deterioration of our relations with France, and France throwing in her lot with Germany and making it a whole lot easier for the Germans to stand up to the United States and object to the United States policy in 1962. and we did that because you couldn't say yes to the French and then say no to the Germans. And also they had the policy of trying to get the British out of the nuclear business, because in the long run the notion was you couldn't say yes to the British and then say no to the French. But if you said yes to the French, then you would have the German problem. So that was the strategy that was adopted in April of 1961, still intact in 1962. And it led to the poisoning of America's relations with really all three of our big allies in Europe. And Kennedy was determined to change it. Not the policy vis-a-vis Germany, but the policy vis-a-vis Britain and France. Now the whole idea was, we'll help them. We'll help them in the nuclear arena. We'll show that we understand why they don't want to be so absolutely dependent on us, why they want a nuclear force under their own control. Well, not only will we understand that, but we'll help them build these in the nuclear sphere. We'll share our nuclear technology with them. Okay? But in exchange from that, we want them to kind of side with us politically in terms of working out what we want to do with the Soviets. Right? And also, by rebuilding the bloc of the three Western powers, Germany would be isolated. Germany would no longer have a French card to play. Germany can no longer say that in standing up to the Americans, we're not pursuing just our parochial nationalistic German interests. We are standing up for European civilization as a whole. Proof is, look, France sides with us. And if you take that away from the Germans, then it's much easier to bring them to heel. That's the Kennedy calculus. Yeah, pretty much. No one really does. The only reason the Americans opposed this business was because of the German aspect. Right? The Soviet concerns in Europe are focused very heavily on Germany. You can understand why. I mean, it's like, who invaded them twice in the course of the 20th century? Britain? Yeah, well. So the Skybolt business is the occasion for this shift in policy. A Skybolt is a missile that you could deploy on bombers, nuclear-tipped missile. The bombers, they can't drop bombs on the Soviet Union itself because Soviets have greatly improved their air defenses and the ability of the bombers to penetrate is becoming increasingly problematic. But you can give the bombers a new lease on life by giving them these air-launched missiles that they could deploy as they're approaching the Soviet air defense screen, and then the missiles could be fired and they wouldn't be shot down by Soviet air defense. These are ballistic missiles, so they're not subject to air defenses. But it would only be good for a number of years. It would just extend the lease on life of the bombers until maybe the late 60s. And after that, the British wouldn't have anything. And the deal to provide the British with Skybolt had been made under Eisenhower when the policy was very different. Now the people in the State Department said, look, we're stuck with Skybolt if it's viable, but we shouldn't give the British anything more. Because if you give him Polaris or Minuteman, the best American ballistic missiles, you can't defend against these things, then that helps the British have an independent force on a more or less permanent basis, not just for another few years, but a permanent basis. And our goal is to get these people out of the nuclear business, not because we care about the British in themselves, but what we do with the British, we're going to have to do with the French, and then how are you going to deal with the German problem? So that was the State Department line. And there are other people in the government who took the same sort of line for somewhat different reasons. Okay? But what Kennedy does, it becomes clear that Skybolt is not going to be produced for, just not worth it in money terms when the Americans have all these better weapons that they could produce. And so the question arises, what are the British going to be offered as a substitute? And these people in the State Department and elsewhere, they wanted to kind of, continue with the policy that had been adopted in 61 and say, you shouldn't give the British anything that's really any good. You certainly shouldn't give them the Polaris, a submarine-launched ballistic missile, Minuteman, or our best ICBM. Just kind of give them junk, basically, that wouldn't enable them to be a nuclear power on a permanent basis. And Kennedy decides to break with this policy. Okay? That's the meaning of the policy he pursues in November and December 1962, right after the missile crisis. Now, the key thing is he's willing to give the British Polaris, right? Enable Britain, in other words, to remain an independent nuclear power for an indefinite period. Not just that, but he's willing to offer the same sort of arrangement to the French, that we would help the French, deploy Polaris. But only as part of a far-reaching deal where the French support the Americans on these basic political issues vis-a-vis Germany and Russia. Right? And this is this is what Kennedy tells the French ambassador when he meets with him in Palm Beach, Florida, right after the Christmas vacation. He has our ambassador. He instructs personally our ambassador in Paris, Charles Bolin, to tell the French leader de Gaulle that this is what the Americans want to do. And de Gaulle's interested. Then what happens? And this story is quite remarkable because it shows you something about the kind of government we have in this country. The Undersecretary of State, George Ball, who's like the top official in this whole faction within the government that thinks that you have to say no to the British and the French and keep the Europeans from getting their hands on nuclear weapons because otherwise the German question will be unmanageable. Ball was appalled by the agreement that Kennedy had reached with the British Prime Minister at the Nassau Conference to provide the British with this weapon, he says. It's like, what nerve the president has, a mere politician, presuming to dictate policy. That's the attitude of these guys. It's like so Ball goes over to Europe and he tells the Europeans, the Germans and the French, oh no, President Kennedy hasn't changed policy. All this stuff about helping the Europeans with nuclear weapons, that's only in the condition that it would be part of this multilateral force, in other words, a force that they couldn't control because everything would be subject to American veto. De Gaulle's furious. He feels, I've been led down the garden path. Also, who speaks for the U.S. government? Is it Bolin, who says he's speaking for the president, or George Ball? These Americans, they just don't have their act together. This is not a serious government. So I'm fed up. He gets fed up. Ball's goal was to sabotage the policy, and he succeeded. Because what happens then is that de Gaulle gives a very famous press conference, January 14th, 1963, rising up against the Americans. The occasion for it was the whole question of should Britain be allowed to come into the European Economic Community? Britain had wanted to come in. Now de Gaulle vetoes that. And the reason he vetoes it, he says, Britain, they're just an American satellite. They'll be a Trojan horse within the European community. Europe has to stand up on its own against the Americans. The Americans just want to kind of keep us down. And so we're not going to allow the British to come in, because then Europe would no longer have any real, you know, independent political personality. Europe would just be absorbed into this vast Atlantic community under American direction and control. That's actually a quote. And then a week later, the German Chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, comes to Paris and he signs an important treaty with de Gaulle, a treaty of friendship called the Élysée Treaty. And basically, from the American point of view, de Gaulle, Adenauer is basically aligning himself with de Gaulle. The continental Europeans, they're standing up to the United States. They're rebelling against American leadership. Americans are just absolutely livid. You very rarely see such raw emotions expressed in the documents. These people, they're absolutely dependent on us for their protection, and now look at the way they're treating us. And so what the Americans do is they get very much involved in internal German politics, and they encourage all these people within Germany to rise up against Adenauer, and they basically force Adenauer from the chancellorship. And certainly that was Adenauer's view, that the Americans forced him out of office in 1963. We drew the line in the sand. You want American political protection? Military protection? Well, then you do what we want politically. Right? You align yourselves with us. And say, if you want to pursue a truly independent line, you know, and align yourself with the French policy of de Gaulle, so on, yeah, go right ahead and do it. But just forget about, you know, calling on us if you ever get into trouble. It's very rough language. So the Germans are scared, and they get rid of Adenauer, and the Germans basically accept the American terms. It's not the way Kennedy wanted to do it. He wanted to do it in a more indirect way, rather than just have a very sharp public confrontation of that sort. Okay. Europeans are brought into line. What about the Soviets? The Soviets don't accept any deal in any direct formal way. And that's okay with the Americans, because as long as the understandings are tacit, that's probably even better. You know, certainly more viable vis-a-vis the Europeans. And so in people's minds, the various linkages have been established between the whole question of a German nuclear force and the whole question of Berlin. And there's an objective linkage as well, because if the Soviets want to prevent Germany from developing a nuclear force, they should leave Berlin intact. Because as long as Berlin is vulnerable to Soviet pressure, then the West Germans are deterred from going nuclear for fear that if they did go nuclear, the Soviets would then move against Berlin. You want to protect Berlin, you have to accept a non-nuclear status. And there are all kinds of connections like that that have become clear in people's minds over the past 3 years as these issues were negotiated. Okay? No need to put things down in writing in any formal way. The understandings take shape in the context of the negotiations in July of 1963 for a nuclear test ban treaty, the limited nuclear test ban treaty signed in 1963. People look at stuff like all these arms control things, and they say, this is not a political issue, this is a human issue. Everyone has an interest in arms control, because it's so important to control the nuclear arms race. The nuclear arms race is a problem in and of itself. You know, there are all these notions around. The important thing to realize about arms control in general, and this arms control treaty in particular, is that they're political at their core. The goal of the limited test ban treaty was not to slow the arms race. Wouldn't prevent either America and Russia from just continuing to test missiles and build new weapons and so on. The goal of a test ban is to deter new countries from coming into it. from developing new nuclear weapons, because if you can't test, you can't build. So it's a measure designed to curtail the spread of nuclear weapons, a kind of non-proliferation measure, as we would now say. And so who was it directed against? Well, it's very clear that it was directed against, well, two countries in the American view, the Federal Republic of Germany and the People's Republic of China. You know, we engage in this policy of trying to negotiate a test ban in order to deter new countries from going nuclear and to establish an international norm under the cover of which existing nuclear powers could act to destroy the emerging nuclear capabilities of new powers. Okay? And in particular, from the American point of view, the idea was to provide the framework for preemptive action against the Chinese nuclear program, because it seemed that China was well on the way to developing a nuclear capability of its own. The Chinese were to explode their first bomb in 1964. Okay? The Americans were serious about attacking the Chinese nuclear facilities at Lopnor in western China, and actually brought this issue up a lot with the Soviets. Soviets weren't willing at this point to go quite that far. End of the decade, it's a totally different story. Okay? So there are these kind of broader goals. Soviets don't go along with the whole idea of moving against China. And so what would the Americans be getting as quid pro quo from their offer, basically, to keep West Germany non-nuclear? Well, they want one main thing, West Berlin. And they want the Soviets to agree to lay off in West Berlin. Soviets don't want to make any formal commitments, but informally they suggest, yeah, this is, you know, this West Berlin is no longer a problem. In any event, the test ban is like the tip of the iceberg. The top, you know, 3-4% is what people could see. The really important stuff is what happens below the surface. And it's like this whole web of understandings had come into being by July of 1963. You know? Both sides would accept the status quo, basic status quo in Europe. We'd respect Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence. They would live with the NATO system, and because it helped provide for the containment of German power, the Americans would see to it that West Germany remained non-nuclear. You know, so Soviets, you know, lay off Berlin. All these were elements of the system. They get rounded out by certain other things, like the parallel between Cuba, which remains a Soviet dependency, and West Berlin. They move against West Berlin. Well, in theory, we could retaliate by moving against Cuba, which is within easy reach of American military power. There's a balance of payments aspect to this whole story, too. Americans are running this big balance of payments deficit. And in order to finance that deficit, the Americans want West Germany to foot the bill, basically, for a lot of it. And so the deal is, if you kind of help us manage the balance of payments problem, will agree to the permanent presence of a sizable American force in Europe, because it's that force that's responsible for the balance of payments problem. So these are arrangements that are worked out between the Americans and the West Germans. The bottom line is that all of these different aspects of what was going on, these different arrangements, are elements in a system. Right? They all are part of a structure that provides the basis for a relatively stable international order. Because the world, like this is what I was saying at the beginning of the lecture, the world after 1963 is very different from the world before 1963. Yes, the Cold War continues. There problems remain, and I'll talk about some of them next time. But they're not fundamental. Right? You no longer have these dramatic crises. You no longer have these heroic policies. You know, because it's much more of a normal system. International politics loses its apocalyptic edge. the threat of a general nuclear war recedes very dramatically. All these arrangements that had come into being as a product of the Cold War provide the basis for a relatively stable international order for the rest of the Cold War period down to 1991. So anyway, what I'm going to do next time on Monday is talk about the remaining part of the Cold War in a fairly cursory way. And then on Wednesday, just sum up everything for the course as a whole.